Hi, my name is Ben Atkinson, and welcome to Season 3 of the Functional Health Podcast. I'm trained in both biomedical science and nutrition, and I firmly believe that a holistic and functional approach to health is fundamental to our well-being. I interview some of the leading voices in nutrition and lifestyle medicine, from practitioners to professors and everyone in between. With this podcast, I will share with you their stories, their expertise, and their advice, shedding light on the industry from each of their perspectives and providing you with simple tips and tricks to help improve your health from today. This week, I'm delighted to share with you my conversation with Professor Robert Thomas. Rob is a professor of sports and biological science, consultant oncologist, and is a clinical tutor at Cambridge University. In part one of this conversation, we speak about the broad spectrum of lifestyle interventions to help combat and prevent cancer. I hope you find the conversation informative and useful. So, without further ado, Rob, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ben. It's nice to be on it.
So, Rob, just a little bit of background about you. Why were you interested in studying medicine?
Oh, well, that was quite a long time ago, Ben. I finished in 1984. Not really sure about why I studied medicine. I mean, it was, you know, as I said, you go through school in South Wales and you didn't really have a lot of career guidance. And I only realised that university was law, engineering or medicine. And, you know, I'm not particularly interested in the law or engineering, so it was the third one. Normally people ask me why I'm interested in the slightly different path I've taken since becoming a doctor, where I've got interested not only oncology but also lifestyle and functional medicine.
Absolutely.
As part of that, and I can expand on that if you like.
Yes, 100%, please do.
Right, well, I've always been interested in making sure patients are empowered. I suppose the moment which people look back on was three to six months into my first consultant job in Cambridge and Bedford. And it was typical NHS, you know, 40 patients a day, 5 minutes of consultation, you know, frontline stuff. And we did an audit and we asked patients, you know, their satisfaction. Clearly, most people weren't satisfied with their consultations because it was short and rushed. But we did notice that the patients who were satisfied also commented they were able to share the decisions with myself and other doctors, and they felt empowered with the knowledge to be part of the decision-making process. Mm-hmm. So that was a sort of moment I thought, well, if we can get patients on board, it'll be good for them and also more efficient for the unit. So back then it was more about information, providing videos and information about their treatment options. And obviously that's routine now. It was quite unusual back in sort of early 90s. And more recently, or I suppose in the last 15 years, the issues with patients was more that they felt a little bit confused of what they can do to help themselves either during their cancer treatments or afterwards. For various reasons, which I'm sure we can go into, you know, not quite sure what to eat, how much to exercise, whether they should exercise, whether they should be taking supplements. So
yes,
it was really done to improve the consultation with a patient, and also for my own lifestyle benefit. You know, I'd like to know the truth as well in my own lifestyle choices, and that then led to setting up a research unit to try and find out much of the information, which has been largely not unknown, but not firmly established.
So just to zoom out, and we'll take a macro view and then we'll dive into the details in a second.
Yeah.
So for people who are listening, which they know kind of the symptoms of cancer, tumours is one of them, what actually is cancer?
Good question. Put a pause there. Cancer is basically an abnormal proliferation of cells where the normal growth regulatory pathways have been disrupted. So I'm trying to put that in a lay term. So mm-hmm. for example, a normal cell would grow to a certain size and the population of that cells in the environment would stop growing, or they would die naturally. So that, for example, the skin would grow to a certain thickness and then not grow thicker. but a cancer cell decides that they don't want to die at the end of their natural life and will continue to grow. And of course, they then run out of space. So if you have those cells within a prostate, for example, they will be very dense and they will form a mass, which is sometimes called a tumor. And then, of course, they need to, in order to survive, they need to expand. So they will grow out of the organ, and they have a number of mechanisms to actually grow and spread to other parts of the body. So that's the definition of a cancer, to invade other organs and to spread to other parts of the body.
Okay, and I've heard many people say it before that we have cancer cells in our body now, but our body has the ability to deal with them. Why does this system stop working?
So we do actually have some circulating cancer cells from time to time in our body, which don't then form into full-grown cancers. But I think what you're referring to is we have the genetic breaks or the genetic damage in our DNA, which programs the cell to become cancerous. So those genetic mutations we're born with. And when we then are exposed to some carcinogen or lead a lifestyle which is pro-inflammatory, we develop a situation called oxidative stress, and that oxidative stress leads to genetic damage. And when our genes are damaged, they rearrange. So these areas, these small sort of codes for cancer, which have previously been suppressed by other genes, or they're not in a part of the gene which is doing anything active, they then go into a part of the gene which is then activated. And that's when the cells start behaving badly. So it's essentially, it's all pre-programmed, but through evolution and various other factors, we've kept them at bay.
Okay, so it's almost the genes create the program, but the environment starts it, if you will.
Absolutely right. So once we've we could talk all day just on this. When a cell divides, certain mutations happen naturally. So it's not just because we've gone out and had a burnt sausage and washed down with a can of fizzy drink. I mean, it's every day we get these mutations developing. And the cell is able to deal with them. So it has a whole load of pathways, such as DNA repair, which is the next one. So the cell would then, the body will recognize a cell with mutations and either kill it, repair the mutations, and if it doesn't, a cell will continue growing with the mutations. Now that's the dangerous part. Mm-hmm. And that's what forms into a cancer cell. But even then, the body will recognize those cells as foreign in the majority of cases. So it's estimated we have up to about 3,000 cancer cells forming every day, especially if you go into the sun or sunburn or have something like that, and your immunity is able to kill them. So it's only when the immunity has failed that those cells will take a grip. And then once they've taken a grip, then they start growing and spreading and forming masses. So there's a whole series of events before a single mutation leads to, a metastatic cancer.
Everyone's interested right now in minimizing risk of cancer, because it seems the prevalence and incidence of cancer now is rising in the UK, at least from the statistics. And you've written a book, Your Lifestyle After Cancer, and your most recent book coming out in March next year, or March 2020, which is Keep Healthy After Cancer. And I want to dive into some of the reasons how people can maybe prevent cancer and also prevent its reoccurrence and help recovery from treatment. Now, you mentioned the sun. Mm. Now, everyone loves going on holiday and being in the sun. People are sun worshippers. Is some exposure to the sun beneficial because of the vitamin D that we produce when it hits our skin? Or do you think sun is completely harmful? What would you say?
When we talk about carcinogens, of which sun is potentially one of them, you've always got to look at your inherent genetic susceptibility to them, the level of exposure and what lifestyle habits counterbalance them. So if you think it as a weighing scale, you've got to be always in the protective end of the scale rather than the other end. So for example, if you haven't been on holiday for a while, you go to Benidorm, you sit on a deck chair for 3 hours with no suntan cream, you are going to burn, your skin's going to go bright red, and that is highly carcinogenic. And if you do that before the age of 18, that will increase the risk of melanoma. And the number of melanomas is increasing a lot because, of course, in Western countries, we're becoming more affluent, we're affording holidays, etc. On the other hand, you've just pointed out that sun has beneficial effects. It helps improve the circadian rhythm. Mm-hmm. The light is good, in the morning, so that's good for you. It provides vitamin D, and vitamin D protects you from a number of chronic disorders, including cancer. And of course, it's vital for the metabolism of bone. So it's a question of common sense. Sunburning is the worst. So gentle sun exposure without burning is beneficial. It'll increase DNA. But also what you put on your skin, what you put on your skin afterwards, and what you eat and do at the same time. Now, there's a thing called a two-hit theory. So if you, if you're smoking, for example, or eating, carcinogenic meat while you're sunbathing, you've got three things which are moving in the wrong direction. So that weighing scale is very heavily tipped towards getting cancer. If you are, on the other hand, having a good lifestyle, you're exercising, you're eating polyphenol-rich foods and minerals and vitamins which protect you from cancer, and afterwards you put on a very good after-sun cream which contains olive oil, which is the best one, then you're doing everything you can to protect yourself. So you get the benefit of the sun and the protection. I was really interested in a trial recently showing that a glass of red wine, the resveratrol in red wine, is very good for protecting the sun after sunburn. So that's a good excuse for a glass of wine after going to the beach, isn't it?
It certainly is. And just to touch upon some things that you said there, as a practical tip, what would you say is a good amount of time being in the sun? Because some people say you should let your skin go bright pink because that's the capillaries opening up, but then get out of the sun because you don't want to burn after that.
As I just said, it's to do with your genetic susceptibility as well. Of course, if you're if you're ginger hair and pale, you're gonna burn. So you need to do lots of light and sort of frequent sun exposure with lots of gaps. But if you've got dark skin, you're probably more you're more protected against it. Also, it depends on, as I said, your diet, whether you're exercising, whether you smoke. So it's all individual. I wouldn't burn. So anything which causes burning increases inflammation, and that inflammation is also pro-carcinogenic at the same time. So I definitely try not to burn. What I say to my patients is, look, get out there in the autumn and the spring particularly, expose as much skin as you can. If you've got a garden, sort of get down to your bathing suit or whatever, and expose the area of skin which is not used to the sun. Most of us, however, we sit in a cafe, we have sun burning down in the front of our chest or on our forehead and neck or back of the hands, and that's when it leads to skin damage and, of course, cancer in those areas. So try to expose a bit which aren't normally burnt.
So nudist beaches, things like that.
Yes, that would be a great example, Ben. I must try it one day.
And you said olive oil is the best to put on after you're in the sun.
Yeah.
But I've heard aloe vera.
Aloe vera does have some anti-inflammatory properties, and it's amazing how people always say aloe vera. It is actually used for burns. So it burns from sun or burn from chemicals or heat. But most of the evidence comes from laboratory studies which have looked at mice who've been exposed to sun and things. And you can actually measure a chemical which relates to how much genetic damage was done during that event. And there was, for example, a very good study which with a sunbathing mice had olive oil massage into the skin afterwards compared to ones who didn't. And there was a very significant reduction in the number of skin cancers they subsequently developed, number of skin damage, and this chemical which reflected DNA damage. Wow. So olive oil is by far the best after sun lotion you can use. You can either just use olive oil before you go into the shower, or most good after suns will have olive oil in them if you look carefully. And of course, avoid any creams which might be harmful in other ways, with ones with lots of colours, perfumes, or preservatives which could irritate the skin precisely at a time you don't want to be putting more chemicals on it.
Now, just to dive a little bit deeper into food, which is something that you mentioned before, or the lack of food. So a lot of people would believe fasting is very good for them, this current data now, which is showing it's beneficial in some instances. There is a group of people that suggest that you should fast pre-chemotherapy and pre-radiotherapy. What's your take on this?
I have had patients approach me and ask me this, and in fact, a couple of other hospitals have asked me to do a literature review of the evidence. And in fact, this is something we do in our research unit. We look at topics such as this, and we look at the world evidence, and if there's no evidence out there, we might design a study to try and get the evidence. So on my blog, which is blog.cancernet.co.uk, we have done an evidence review, so I'd welcome everyone to read it. It's quite complex. But in a nutshell, the evidence in humans for fasting pre-chemotherapy in terms of an increased cancer response is not there. There's a couple of studies with 10 or 15 patients in, very small, not statistically robust, and none of them have shown that it'll improve your outcomes, I'm afraid. However, in theory, there are some benefits, because when you fast, you reduce your sugar levels, you reduce this chemical called insulin-like growth factor, all of which can reduce inflammation, and you get this supposed differential change in proliferation rate between cancer cells and normal cells. So when we withdraw the sugar effectively, or sugar levels drop, and these other three chemicals I just mentioned drop, normal cells tend to slow their proliferation, whereas cancer cells aren't affected by it. So therefore, they continue growing. And when you then give the chemotherapy, which attacks faster growing cells, you supposedly get this differential response. So there is some theory behind it, but in practice, it's not been shown. There are some data to say that if you are overweight, it helps you reduce weight. And if you are if you have nausea, it can reduce the nausea associated with chemotherapy. But at the moment, the data is premature to consider that. And there are ongoing studies, as one in Phoenix, for example. I think the future would also be looking at fasting mimickers. So could you have a drug which would make it easier for patients? Of course, theoretically, I'm against that sort of thing. I think it's not that hard to fast for a little while. But nevertheless, for a lot of patients, they'd be more attractive to a drug. And some of the drugs would be something like metformin. A drug we use for breast cancer called Afinitor is thought to be a fasting mimicker. But a subject which I'm very interested in is called polyphenols. Now, these are the things in food which give it its colour, its taste and its smell. And they have enormous health benefits, but they also act as fasting mimickers. They reduce inflammation, they reduce insulin-like growth factor, and they help reduce blood sugar by slowing the transport of glucose across the gut wall. So they are a perfect fasting mimicker. However, many oncologists think that you should avoid these foods because they might counterbalance the chemo, which is actually not true. Most of the trials show they're beneficial.
I would like to touch upon antioxidants in just a second, but you mentioned fasting, and we were saying fasting, but how long would a fast last in this instance, and are there any risks to doing it?
Well, the limited number of trials have excluded patients who have a low body weight, so BMI less than 20 or have problems with diet. And of course, you can get some people who are very enthusiastic about helping themselves or go off on a bit of a tangent. So the last thing you want to do is get cachexic because you've not eaten enough. So yes, there is a danger of that. The other danger is we don't really know. I mean, medicine, you know, for good reasons, there are randomized trials which have been confirmed and audited very thoroughly before we change policy. And to have a couple of trials and a few theoretical benefits, it's a bit premature because you never know. It could end up, there could be some unknown damage, which we find out in the future with more robust trials. Problem is, it's not an area which is being researched that thoroughly. As I said, there's a few trials around the world, but so the data is going to be slow to mature on that one.
Thank you for clarifying. Now, you mentioned polyphenols, and this is something which I believe everyone's going to be interested in, because these polyphenols are a type of antioxidant found in food. So what foods should people eat to help prevent cancer but also help to maximize treatment effectiveness?
Good. That's a good way of putting it, because they have multiple benefits before, during, and after cancer. Just to sort of go back a step, the natural foods, natural chemical in foods called phytochemicals, of which the biggest group is polyphenols. So there are others, and they have multiple benefits. In fact, I was told off recently for using the word antioxidant.
Right.
So I still use it. So that is only one of their benefits. Okay. So most of them are not directly antioxidant. They don't directly mop up free radicals. Some do, such as vitamin E and some vitamin A, and there are issues with those foods, actually. In fact, there are some studies which show if you take supplements of vitamin E and A, they could counterbalance drugs and they could increase your cancer rate. So I'll come back to those later. In terms of polyphenols, they enhance the antioxidant enzymes, which is slightly different of saying they're directly antioxidant. They just make sure your antioxidant system is running efficiently, which is good. They directly reduce inflammation in the body, which again, we know that excess inflammation drives cancer cells and a lot of other degenerative diseases. They improve gut health by helping to feed the good gut bacteria. And they have direct benefits on how genes are expressed. So if you're born with a dodgy gene, a gene which is more likely to promote cancer, it can alter the expression of that, called epigenetics. And we could go on and on and on. There's probably over 100 benefits in the body what polyphenols do, with the antioxidant pathway just being one of them.
Okay. Perfect. So in terms of, because you mentioned vitamin E and A, and people are thinking, hang on, I thought supplements were beneficial. Are eating foods with vitamin A and E in beneficial, or are they harmful as well? Let's clarify that.
No. So we get this information from a number of sources. We look at animal data and large cohort studies. So in fact, we're analysing one at the moment from California with 155,000 people in, and we sort of probe the data set to try to find out what habits promote cancer. Nearly all, well, the one we're looking at and nearly all the others, of which there's hundreds, none of them show that sort of vitamin A rich foods or vitamin E rich foods or polyphenol rich foods do any harm. In fact, the opposite. Most of them show they do enormous benefits. They reduce the risk of cancer. They help you cope with cancer treatments, and they reduce the risk of relapse. So it is perfectly safe to eat all these sort of healthy foods, fruits, vegetables, herbs, spices, etc. The danger comes in when you start removing chemicals from foods and putting them into a pill. If you put, and I'm not talking about getting whole foods and putting them in a pill or just drying them or concentrating them, but if you say remove vitamin A or E or even say zinc or selenium, and then you're sort of getting into the territory of creating a drug, really. And there are some data to say, I mean, because a lot of randomized trials have been done on those mineral and vitamin supplements, and there are some data where they've increased the relapse rate from, say, skin cancers or head and neck cancers. And even folic acid, for example, was given in a study in people who'd had heart attacks, and that slightly increased the risk of cancer. And these studies actually had to be stopped. So my general advice to people is, unless you know you've got a deficiency in those minerals, which is often hard to find out, I would steer clear of regular intake of those supplements.
Okay. So are there ones in particular which should be completely avoided? And on that same token, are there ones which you think people should take?
Right. So if we do a test online where you can measure your micronutrients, but it's quite expensive, and it's a snapshot in time. And if people do that test, then and we see that they're deficient in one of those elements, I would advise them to take a supplement for a period of time to correct it. You know, the classic one, if you're vitamin D deficient, for example, you should take vitamin D. There's not a lot of data. You'd have to take a lot of vitamin D for it to do any harm. So it would be fairly safe to take vitamin D through the winter months, for example, and you're probably doing yourself a lot of benefit. Taking a vitamin A or vitamin E supplement, you're on sort of thin ice there. You'd really need to know what you're doing, and it's best to steer clear of those. Probiotics, which is effectively a supplement, which are healthy bacteria dried and put into a pill, there is some data to support taking those regularly. Not all the time, and if you have a good gut health, they probably don't add a lot. But if you feel you've got a bad gut health, if you're getting lots of indigestion or bloating or intermittently constipated with diarrhea, it probably indicates you've got a bad gut health. There is some data for taking them. Or if you're going into hospital, or you've had recent antibiotics or chemotherapy or radiotherapy, or indeed traveling. So that's another group I would recommend of probiotic supplements. Make sure it's a good one though. And then the other group is polyphenol-rich supplements, where people have just literally got, say, broccoli or tea or turmeric or one of these things, put them into a pill in a way to boost a normal diet, or if you don't eat a lot of those foods, to sort of supplement not eating correctly.
Just to be clear, you can't out-supplement a poor diet, right? I think we're both in agreement there.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, 100% go for dietary change.
I mean,
nobody is saying you could sort of get up, have a tequila for breakfast, and then take a few supplements, and you'll be fine.
But yeah, we might wish that, but no. You mentioned the microbiome and also probiotics. Now, this is a question and a topic which comes up quite a lot since I've been doing the podcast. There's particular probiotics out there, and ones which don't have any data behind them, ones which include multiple strains, 14 different strains, for example, or above, and ones which only include one. What would you recommend to improve gut health, or as it pertains to cancer?
Well, taking the question back, what would you do to improve gut health? There's a number of factors. Okay, so first of all, keeping your weight down. Secondly, exercising regularly. Third, reducing processed sugar. So that none of those involve bacteria.
Yes.
Processed sugar feed unhealthy bacteria. In fact, unhealthy bacteria like sugar. They grow fast when you ingest it, and the healthy bacteria paradoxically don't use sugar. They actually use breakdown products from polyphenols. So that's the first thing to consider. Then of course you need to have the bacteria as well. So miso soup, kimchi, kefir, sauerkraut, things with bacteria in them. And of course, you need the prebiotics to enhance their growth. And what prebiotics do is they tend to, they have antibiotic effects in them, like in mushrooms, which kill the bad bacteria, but not the good ones. They allow more space for the bacteria, good bacteria, to grow. So it's not just a simple case of taking a load of bacteria. You have to support the growth of it. You know, the classic example, you can't just put seeds on the patio and expect it to grow on the concrete. You have to give the fertile ground for it. But there are situations where a probiotic supplement would be beneficial. As I said, if you're traveling or if you're going into hospital, sportsmen and women often take them because there's some evidence it reduces the risk of viral infections like colds, which will delay your training. So I myself take them, you know, in those situations. But you know, how many strains to use? A good question. In Cambridge, we're doing a microbiome project, which is analysing the number of bacteria in volunteers. And you know, there's thousands of bacteria in the gut, and there's new bacteria being discovered every week. In fact, they've stopped publishing about the new bacteria because it's so common that people aren't, you know, interested in that discovery of a new strain of species. But I would say the optimum would be about 4 or 5 bacteria, and go for the Lactobacillus and Bifidus strains. They're the ones, through the research I've read, seem to be most beneficial in terms of correcting your gut health. And you know, there's several on the market. I like the one, the Nature Medical one, which has got 5 strains. It's not too expensive, and it's got a prebiotic built in. It's got a short shelf life, and it's made in Britain. Whereas you know, ones which have, you know, 20 or 30, I don't think they're adding much. And of course, the other end, if you just have like a little, I won't use the brand name, but a little drink in a small pot with just Lactobacillus in it, you're really only promoting one strain. And some of those have milk and sugar added. And if you're lactose intolerant, it might be counterproductive as well.
Okay, so we've covered fasting. We've touched upon foods and supplements. Now, are there any foods there which you think absolutely everyone should be eating if they want to help prevent cancer, maximize treatment effectiveness, and prevent reoccurrence? Big question.
It is a big question. I'm very much into sort of individualized nutrition.
Yes.
Of course, people talk about gluten, for example. Well, if you are not gluten intolerant, then it's perfectly safe for you to eat grains and things, and whole grains. But if you are, you're going to get an inflammation when you eat those, and inflammation is bad for the gut and for the body. So it's a case of identifying what foods suit you and what don't. Same applies for milk. If you're lactose intolerant, you've got to avoid milk products. If you're not lactose intolerant, then probably milk is good for you to a certain extent, as long as it's, you don't have too much and it's not, doesn't gain weight. There are other more rare things like phytic acid and pectin, which you can get in other grains, and the paleo enthusiasts all say we should avoid those. But again, it's very much an individual thing if you are insensitive to those. So it's a case of being aware of your own body. If you feel healthy, if your gut feels healthy, you're probably on the right track. The absolute no-nos would, of course, be the carcinogenic foods. And these would be the acrylamides, the polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons.
From burnt meat and things like that.
Yeah, exactly. Meat is pretty, it seems to have everything wrong with it, especially if it's burnt. So burnt meat you've just mentioned, cheap meats, fatty meats. It also depends on what you eat them with, of course, because nitroso compounds, which are also present in meats, are actually present in plants. In beetroot, for example, has got a lot of nitroso. But when you eat some meat, but you eat it with vitamin C or polyphenols, the nitroso compounds are converted into nitric oxide, which is healthy. Whereas if you eat them on their own, they're converted to nitrous amines, which are carcinogenic. So that's an example of making sure you combine the meal. So if you do have a bit of meat, make sure it's with lots and lots of greens, fruit, vegetables, herbs and spices, because that will prevent it becoming carcinogenic. But if what most people do, you know, you have a chunk of meat which is burnt, full of carcinogens, and you wash it down with a can of sugary drink or something.
And that's, chips.
And well, chips on their own, if you have them with, you know, they are potato, they've got acrylamines in it, which is a carcinogen. But if
because
you,
the frying in the oil.
Correct, yes. Yeah. But, you know, if you have it with lots of vegetables and spices, actually you're mitigating the harm from them. And, you know, everyone likes a chip, don't they? Let's face it. You have to eat something.
Yes. I've heard from various people who've had cancer in the past that one of the hardest things to do when you have cancer is motivate yourself to exercise, or even knowing if you should exercise. What are your thoughts on that?
Probably one of the first behavioural changes I got into back in 15 years ago was exercise, because that is one of the most important, to be honest. You're right. I mean, many patients are told to take it easy during treatment and, you know, don't worry about it. But cancer, of course, is 15 years behind cardiology. It was only back then people were told to rest after a heart attack, and now we know the complete opposite. We know that exercise does many of the things which I've already talked about, reduces inflammation, improves gut health. It keeps the weight down if you're overweight. If you're outside, it improves circadian rhythm and vitamin D levels. So there's multiple benefits. But, you know, you've just been hit with chemotherapy or radiotherapy, you're feeling dreadful, a bit nauseated, lethargic. It's very hard to motivate yourself. And that's why my ambition really is that oncology units take on board the supervised exercise program for patients to make it easier for them. There's a private group of hospitals called Genesis Care which have actually done that. They've built a gym next to the radiotherapy and chemo suite, so when you come for your chemo and radiotherapy, you get invited to go into the gym first. I mean, I'd love that to be in every oncology unit in the UK, but and I think it would actually be cost effective, but I think it'd be very difficult to get that approved. But yeah, I mean, you just got to do as much as you possibly can and accept it's going to be hard, and get family members to help you if you can afford it, a personal trainer. Many gyms now have gym instructors who've been qualified in exercise rehabilitation related to cancer. It's called a level 4 qualification, which you know, they're better at motivating patients who are feeling lethargic or being sensitive to the side effects of treatment. So if you can make sure your exercise professional has this qualification, it's probably better. But we're still a long way away, to be honest. It's still needs improvement.
So in terms of the type of exercise, would you recommend resistance training or cardiovascular training?
Well, as an exercise scientist now at University of Bedford, you know, we're looking at all the literature and designing our own studies, and you know, there's a lot of data out there, and again, it's an individual thing. We know, for example, if you haven't got cancer, about 3 hours a week of moderate to severe, not severe, moderate to intense exercise is beneficial. So you know, ambling around the park looking at the petunias is good. It gets you out, gets some vitamin D, but it doesn't really get those chemicals changing in your body which have the anti-cancer effects. And we recently wrote a paper actually with Stacey Kenfield from California summarizing the over 180 biochemical changes which happen when you exercise, and most of those click in when you really have done something significant. So, you know, sweating, a bit breathless. There was a very good paper recently published which looked at people who exercised on an empty stomach, say before lunch. So if you have your breakfast at 7:30, go for a run or do something at say 1:30, you've got an empty stomach, and that is very good for reducing the chemicals. I've recently, earlier in the program, talked about insulin, like growth factor, insulin levels, and they really, really have a big impact. So the other advice I give is first thing in the morning. If you get up, I know it might be dark and raining and you're feeling a bit tired, but if you can do 10, 15 minutes exercise on an empty stomach first thing in the morning, it really sets the platform for the rest of the day, and it helps you lose weight as well if you're overweight. In terms of intensity, there was a paper called the PACES study, which is from Holland, which randomized people on chemotherapy between a fairly intense regime, moderate or standard care. And it was actually the intense regime which the patients did even better, improved their immunity, reduced nausea, and improved outcomes, actually. So the bottom line is, you know, there's no, you're not going to do yourself any harm even if you do an intense regime. Most of us don't do enough anyway, so the last thing you need to do is worry people about doing too much. And try to do it regularly. Try to do something every day, do something you enjoy, so you're going to carry on doing it.
Thank you so much for that. Rob, we've touched upon fasting, foods, supplements, and exercise so far. For part two of this podcast, please check the next episode. Thank you for listening to the Functional Health Podcast. You can find links to everything that we talked about today in the show notes. If you have a second, please consider leaving a 5-star rating on iTunes. It really does make a huge difference and helps get this valuable information out and reach more people. Don't forget to subscribe so you can stay up to date and know whenever I release a new episode. You can connect with us on Instagram, Facebook, or our website, and all questions are welcome. As always, thanks to Joss Aurelia for the editing and Alan Harper for his support.